Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. In the news this week, President Trump gives his take on the State of the Union.
Let's begin tonight by recognizing that the state of our union is strong because our people are strong.
Washington is divided over the release of the Intelligence Committee memo. California Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff calls it an effort to protect the president and undermine the Russia investigation.
We now know from the FBI that when they finally got a chance to look at it, that the memo is seriously misleading because it omits very material information and has deep factual inaccuracies.
And in Michigan, officials express regret to a victim of Larry Nassar, the Michigan State and USA gymnastics doctor who sexually abused more than 200 young women. Here's Meridian Township Manager Frank Walsh apologizing to Breanne Randall for not responding to her complaint.
To you, Breanna, we failed you, we let you down, and you don't know how sorry. I know we've had a lot of private conversations, private apologies, but we felt this needed to be done in public.
And earlier today, a Michigan father of three victims was restrained when he lunged for Nassar during the final sentencing hearing. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join us on air or online. Would you release that memo? How do you see the state of our union? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Mary Bruce, congressional correspondent for ABC News. And Mary, terrific as always to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Also from Washington, Naftali Ben-David joins us. He's Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome back, Naftali. Great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, happy Friday. Great to have you.
Hello, Anthony, Mary, and Naftali. Excuse me.
So, folks, let's begin with the big fight in Washington over the secret memo from the House Intelligence Committee written by Republican congressional aides. As we go to air, it seems likely that President Trump will give his okay to release the memo, which alleges, among other things, misdeeds by the FBI and the Justice Department at the start of the Russia investigation. Democrats are furious about this. Naftali, I'd like to come to you first about this. Where does this stand? And talk a little bit about the significance of this big fight and controversy in Washington.
Well, it really is extraordinary to see this kind of a dispute between the White House and the law enforcement establishment. So much has happened that's kind of unusual or striking during the Trump administration that we can get a little bit jaded. But there really hasn't been anything like this in a very long time, if ever. The FBI is saying publicly it has grave concerns about the release of the memo. The Justice Department is saying it would be extraordinarily reckless to release it. And let's not forget, this is a Republican administration. The people running these agencies were appointed by President Trump. They're extremely distressed by the release of the memo, but the White House appears to be giving its blessing and really mounting something of an attack on the top leadership of the FBI and the Justice Department. It's really quite a spectacle, and I don't remember anything like this in recent memory.
It's really, really something. Let's listen to a little bit of tape on this story from the week's news. So following the State of the Union address on Tuesday, President Trump was caught on tape telling a lawmaker that he is 100% in favor of releasing this controversial memo. Here's the exchange.
Let's release the memo. Oh, yeah. Oh, don't worry. 100%. Can you imagine?
Yes, sir.
He'd be too angry.
Okay, sound was a little bit hard to hear there, but you heard the president saying, oh, yeah, don't worry, 100% in terms of being in favor of releasing it. Congressman Adam Schiff said on Monday that a vote by the House Intelligence Committee to release this document, alleging missteps by the FBI and the Russia probe, marked a very sad day.
Sadly, we can fully expect that the President of the United States will not put the national interest over his own personal interest. But it is a sad day indeed when that is also true of our own committee, because today this committee voted to put the President's personal interest, perhaps their own political interest, above the national interest, in denying themselves even the ability to hear from the department and the FBI. And that is, I think, a deeply regrettable state of affairs.
And here's House Speaker Paul Ryan at a news conference this week in which he said that it was proper for the House Intelligence Committee Republicans to vote in favor of releasing the memo.
There may have been malfeasance at the FBI by certain individuals. So it is our job in conducting transparent oversight of the executive branch to get to the bottom of that.
So we really heard, Mary Bruce, I'll come to you on this. We really heard the division there in Washington. Naftali said he's never seen anything quite like this. Your response to what's going on?
It's completely divided lawmakers. Look, Republicans overall argue that it shows political bias at the Justice Department that may have tainted the Russia investigation. You heard the Speaker of the House there arguing that it should be released for transparency purposes, that this is a matter of oversight. Democrats overall say this is nothing more than a political hit job, that Republicans are cherry-picking the raw intelligence here to support their conclusion. They accuse Republicans of trying to undermine the entire Russia investigation. But you also have some top Republicans warning, saying that the president needs to be careful here, considering how this bears on our national security. That's how top Republican Senator John Thune described it to reporters. And remember, it's not just lawmakers here. The FBI has been lobbying the White House to try to lower tensions, pleading with the White House not to release this memo. They took that extraordinary step of releasing a statement earlier in the week saying that they have grave concerns about its accuracy, and yet the president is fuming. And instead of dialing down the tension, we've seen the president ratcheting it up. I mean, just this morning, he took to Twitter to attack the top leadership and investigators of the FBI and the Justice Department, saying they've politicized the sacred investigative process in favor of Democrats. And as Naftali points out, this is leadership that the president himself put in power.
It really is something. Jack Beatty, I want to get you in on this as well. I mean, stunning situation in which the FBI itself, now run by Christopher Wray, who was appointed by President Trump, says he has grave concerns about this. So here's the president seemingly at war with his own FBI, his own Department of Justice. What's your take on what's going on?
And the president ultimately may be at war with the rule of law. You know, there's that famous line at the Constitutional Convention of 1787 as it was closing. Someone asked Benjamin Franklin, "Well, Dr. Franklin, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" Franklin's reply, "A republic, if you can keep it." That's the question I think that we're about to face in this country. The release of this memo, as the Times has reported and others have reported, the president himself says this is the beginning of, you know, clearing me of any charges from the Mueller investigation. The point of it is to put a cloud over Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, and to lay down a predicate for Mr. Trump to fire him. And the question then is, what happens to the investigation? And the grave fear, and it seems as if each day lends more substance to it, is that he will install someone who will, essentially geld the Mueller investigation. And then we will have stepped considerably toward, if not a monarchy, an autocracy. You know, the Financial Times writes today, "No one should be in doubt. Were Mr. Trump to fire Mueller, the special counsel, Republicans will not stand in his way." I think we're getting signals that that is true, that essentially he could even get away with essentially breaking the, you know, bursting the bounds of executive authority and installing himself as a kind of authoritarian leader.
Listeners, we're talking about the week in review, and we're starting with this big fight in Washington over the release of this House Intelligence Committee memo from the Republicans. Let's take a call right off the bat from Gabe, who's calling from Cambridge, Mass. Gabe, you're on the air. It's good to have you.
Hey, Anthony.
Hey there.
So, you know, we have seen the locomotive of destruction coming down the track for a while in terms of what this president is doing to our country. But today, like, it arrives. Like, this is the threshold. I mean, this is a new level where the president and many members of his party, congressmen, are actively undermining the FBI and tearing our country apart. And, you know, there's so much to say about the Republicans, but what I would like to say now is that, hey, Democrats, if you really think this guy is a racist, if you really think he's been put there by the nation's enemy and is destroying the country, you got to do something. You got to draw a line. Don't legitimize him by dealing with him. You know, I mean, they obstructed Obama for 8 years because he was black. They said it was because of deficit. We've seen in the last couple months.
Hey, Gabe, I hear where you're coming from, and I appreciate your sentiment, but I want to sort of stick to the memo. Do you think that the Democrats should put pressure somehow on their more pressure? I mean, I guess the question isn't actually, Gabe, if you don't mind, I'm going to turn this question to Naftali Ben-David. Can Democrats do more to sort of insist that their version of the counter memo be released or respond?
I'm not sure
to our
that there's much more that they can do. I mean, if you're in the minority in the House of Representatives, your powers are severely curtailed. The House Intelligence Committee used to be something of an oasis of bipartisanship. I mean, they deal with very sensitive national security matters, and members on both sides seem to be cognizant of that and to sort of try to work together and present a semblance of consensus. But now they're really at war in a very unusual way. And if you watch them, it's like they're conducting two completely separate investigations. The Democrats are conducting an investigation of Russian meddling and any possible involvement of the Trump campaign. The Republicans are conducting an investigation of the FBI and the DOJ. And Chairman Devin Nunes, who's behind a lot of this, has said that relatively openly. And one of the things that Adam Schiff, who's the top Democrat on the committee, has pointed out and complained about is the Democrats, they object to the Republican memo, but they also have one of their own. And that is not being released at the same time as the Republican memo. And that's one of his complaints. He says, look, if you're going to release your Republican partisan memo, then release our Democratic partisan memo, too. And the other thing he's upset about is that the FBI and the DOJ, you know, he wants them to come and brief the committee members about their concerns. That's something else that Chairman Nunes has declined to do. So we're seeing a situation of great hostility between Democratic and Republican members of the committee in a way that's not typical.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're talking about the week's top stories. You can join the conversation. Did Joe Kennedy set the right tone in his Democratic response to the president's State of the Union address? What about President Trump's decision not to impose sanctions on Russia? And my guests this hour are Naftali Ben-David of The Wall Street Journal, Newspoint analyst Jack Beatty, and Mary Bruce of ABC News. And Mary, let me just pick up with you, because I'd love to sort of wrap up this part of our conversation about this memo before the break. Jack spoke pretty passionately about this being a really sort of frightening, almost first step toward a reinstatement of a monarchy. I mean, do you see it in such dire terms?
There is no question that the kinds of attacks that we are seeing from the president against the top leadership and investigators of the FBI and the Justice Department is shocking, unprecedented, and it raises a lot of questions on Capitol Hill and across the country. And I think, you know, as even if this memo does come out and it turns out that it is a bit of a dud, shall we say, if it doesn't fulfill some of the hype that some of the allegedly the story Republicans claim it tells, in many ways you could argue that the narrative here is already set. That after Republicans wrote this memo, then spent weeks debating whether or not to release their own memo, you've seen the president's supporters you really ramp up this call to release the memo. You've seen this storyline set in many ways. So even if Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee, you know, ultimately are able to release their memo, which they say acts as a counterpoint, this broader conversation has already been baked. And that's the real concern, I think, going forward for a lot of people on the Hill as they look at how this investigation may be being called into question, the broader Russia investigation. And when they look at the way that the president seems to be continually criticizing the leadership that he himself has put into power, what that means for these institutions going forward, it raises a lot of questions about how the president is going to to interact with these institutions going forward, and whether their credibility is on the line in terms of the White House's point of view.
Boy, a lot of questions, big questions, troubling questions. We're going to move on, though, from this particular subject, because there's a lot of other stories from this week that I want to get to. So let's talk about another big development related to all of this. Deputy FBI Director Andrew McCabe stepped down. He'd said before that he would be leaving the FBI, but this announcement came sooner than a lot of people expected. And Naftali, remind us first who Andrew McCabe is, and the significance of his stepping down.
Well, Andy McCabe is a longtime FBI agent and supervisor. He had been deputy director of the FBI, and he was briefly acting director in between Jim Comey and the current director, Chris Wray. But the reason he has sort of been in the spotlight is that his wife, Jill McCabe, ran for Virginia State Senate in 2015, and she got some financial help from then-Governor Terry McAuliffe. Now, Mr. McAuliffe, in addition to being the governor of Virginia at the time, is also a close ally of Bill and Hillary Clinton. And so when the FBI started looking into Hillary Clinton and her email arrangement, there was some thought that he should step aside from that particular investigation, essentially recuse himself in his deputy role from overseeing that probe. But he didn't. And so that's been a sort of an ongoing source of criticism from some quarters. The president himself has repeatedly tweeted about McCabe and sort of suggested that he was biased. And so when this occurred, the timing did surprise people that it happened this week. But Andy McCabe also was due to, you know, be eligible for his pension in a couple months. He was going to step aside probably in March. So what's most surprising about this is the timing and the fact that McCabe has been one of the FBI and DOJ officials that the White House has been going after. Mm-hmm. So it, of course, you know, seemed like a fairly major development in this ongoing, long-running dispute between the White House and the FBI.
Right. And Mary Bruce, evidence or suggestions that he was sort of pushed early, or what do you make of the timing of him of stepping down?
Yeah, it depends on who you talk to. Republicans note that he was always expected to retire, that he's simply now speeding that up, doing that a bit earlier. Democrats and some Republicans, though, are very concerned that this is a pattern, right? Right, as we've been talking about, the president attacking leadership. And it does come after Trump reportedly asked McCabe who he voted for in the presidential election, which raised a lot of eyebrows and concern. He attacked McCabe's ability to be fair and impartial, once publicly questioned why Attorney General Jeff Sessions didn't replace him. So there was this sort of drumbeat of political pressure from the White House that is very hard to ignore when considering why McCabe decided to leave at this moment.
All right. So another big development this week, or a big story that I want to move on to, and that is President Trump's State of the Union address, in which he called for, among other things, unity. Here's the president.
I call upon all of us to set aside our differences, to seek out common ground, and to summon the unity we need to deliver for the people. This is really the key. These are the people we were elected to serve.
So there's the president, President Trump, in his State of the Union address. President Trump says his allegiances lie first and foremost with American citizens. Here's a little more of what he said.
My duty and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream, because Americans are dreamers too.
President Trump from his State of the Union address earlier this week. Jack, you know, the White House billed this as a nationally unifying and bridge-building speech. On that measure, by their own measure, to what extent did the president succeed? What's your view on that?
Well, if you suspended everything you'd learned about the president in the intervening year since he last spoke to the Congress, then you could say, yes, he's unifying the country. But this was a sort of Potemkin speech, putting a happy face on what's been a year of unprecedented demagogic splintering of the country. And there were flashes of that in the speech, where he used gang members and murderers as sort of metaphors for immigrants. But I think that quote you just had, the Americans have dreams too.
Americans are dreamers too, right?
Yeah, yeah. A caller to our show earlier in the week before the State of the Union on Monday, I guess, used that very phrase to say to sort of voice his resentment at all the attention the Democrats were playing to the dreamers and their plight. It's an undoubtedly serious plight. But I think you have to notice that as the Democrats have been doing that and shutting down the government over it, Mr. Trump has been creeping up in the polls. He's now stabilized at around 40%. In one poll, 42%. I don't know what's caused it, but it is clear that somehow, many Americans, quote, are getting the message that the Democrats are all for this, the dreamers, but not for those American citizens who also have dreams. I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying that seems to be that's how Mr. Trump is casting the Democrats, and the Democrats seem all too willing to follow that that casting.
Mm. You mentioned that poll. It's the latest Monmouth University poll. 42% of Americans approve of the president's job performance. That was up from 32% from Monmouth last month. That same poll, though, 50% registered disapproval. A majority still say the country is on the wrong track. Still, no question that one poll, at least, does suggest the numbers are creeping up. Naftali, I'd love to get your take on the State of the Union address. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is the president took a lot of credit for a strong economy, low unemployment, strong job growth, the booming stock market. There was more good news from the Labor Department today in terms of 200,000 jobs created last month. So I guess my question is, to what extent should the president deserves to take credit for that? And perhaps that explains his poll numbers ticking up a bit.
That would be my guess. I mean, in a way, the country is sort of on this split screen at the moment where the economy does seem to be doing well and there are a lot of more jobs being created. And to that degree, things seem to be headed in the right direction. But from a cultural, political, social perspective, things are splintering apart and there's a lot of anger. And I think one of the big questions for the upcoming midterm elections and beyond is which of those two pictures of the country seems more prevalent. But in terms of your question, I think he can take some credit, but probably not as much as he is taking. It's a fairly standard thing for a president to do. Everything bad that happened is because of the previous administration, and everything good that happened is because of theirs. I think President Trump, as he's wont to do, kind of turned that up a few notches and painted the country implicitly, at least, as almost a bleak wasteland until the day he took office. And ever since then, it's been a land of prosperity and happiness. And, there's some figures like job creation and growth and that sort of thing that really aren't that different between 2017 and 2016, even though he sort of suggested it was otherwise. But there's no question that his moves to cut taxes, for example, and to cut back on regulations have prompted many members of the business community, at least, to move forward and to feel a little bit more optimistic. But it's not really clear which direction the economy is going to go. It's doing well now, but we also, this tax bill increased the deficit significantly. And so there are a lot of good signs and a few worrisome ones at the same time.
Right. Mary, there wasn't a lot of specific new policy proposals in his State of the Union address, but the president did talk about a commitment to bringing down the price of prescription drugs. We talked about that on this program yesterday. Favoring paid family leave, of reforming the prison system to give ex-cons a second chance. And he talked again about a $1.5 trillion infrastructure plan. Is there any reason to believe that any of this will come to fruition in Congress? I mean, is there sort of heft behind these proposals?
It is really hard to see how anything that the president is outlining in terms of an agenda going forward is going to get done in this next year. I mean, just think about the faces that you saw in the State of the Union when Republicans were standing and applauding, and you saw Democrats over and over again stone-faced. Some have been accused of scowling. This is an incredibly bitterly divided Congress. And you have to remember that while the president is there, trying in some ways to outline areas of possible agreement going forward, many of the Democrats sitting there are already eyeing November. They're already looking to 2018 because they feel that this blue wave may be coming. And also, of course, just the practical reality, which is that the president has to work with Democrats if he wants to get anything done, given the fact that in the Senate, the Republicans now have just a one-vote majority. And Democrats right now don't seem exactly too eager to work with this White House on a lot of those issues that he outlined.
And what about the prospects for an immigration deal and whether or not Congress can at least get that done and avoid another government shutdown, Mary? Quickly on that. What do you think?
You are not going to see, I think, an immigration deal wrapped up with a bow ready to go by next Thursday when we see that next deadline. It seems most likely you're headed for another short-term extension. This is a real problem. They really are still pretty far apart here, even though the president has given some more specifics, outlined more in more detail what he wants to see. Lawmakers still have to come together and find a way to push this forward. And I think you going back to that phrase from the president that Americans are dreamers, too, that certainly falls on very different ears. If you are a supporter of the president, you may be applauding that phrase. If you are one of the dreamers sitting in the audience of the State of the Union, worried that the bitter partisanship that you are witnessing in that chamber may mean that deportation is a real possibility in your future, that's a very frightening thing. Now, both parties, of course, agree that they want to protect dreamers. They don't want that to happen. But it's, of course, how and how big of a deal can be done here. And the president's outline, while helpful, and while his increased engagement on this issue has been welcomed on the Hill, even many Republicans have concerns about the plan that he's outlined.
Mm-hmm.
And Anthony, if I could jump in.
Please,
if there's one issue that is going to become more difficult as the November midterms approach, it's immigration, because midterm elections tend to be very heavily dependent on the base. Democrats are looking forward to having their base turn out, hopefully with a lot of enthusiasm. Republicans, to the extent they want to hold the line, they're hoping for the same thing. And immigration is something that's very, very important to those particular bases. So all sensitive issues become more difficult as elections approach because members of Congress don't want to take difficult or potentially volatile votes. But I'd say that immigration is probably chief among those issues. So I think that it's pretty unlikely. There's no sign since this State of the Union of any coming together of the parties. And I think what we can probably expect is that'll just become more difficult in the weeks and months to come.
I want to talk a little bit about the Democratic response. Congressman Joe Kennedy of Massachusetts gave the Democratic response to the president's State of the Union address. So here's a bit of what Kennedy said. He did not mention President Trump by name, but he did make clear that he thought the America of Donald Trump is in trouble.
Russia, knee-deep in our democracy, an all-out war on environmental protection, a Justice Department rolling back civil rights by the day, hatred and supremacy proudly marching in our streets.
I'm curious what the three of you think about the choice of Congressman Joe Kennedy and what he said for the Democratic response. Jack, I'll start with you. You know, I'm wondering what you think about this particular point, and you were just making reference to it. I mean, here are the Democrats desperately thinking about how to appeal to white working class folks who abandoned them in 2016. And here's Joe Kennedy, impressive in many ways, but delivering part of his speech in Spanish to the Dreamers, which, if you think of it, is strange when you consider that part of the argument in favor of them is that they're really Americans. I mean, what did you make of that?
Indeed, that was quite a paradox. And he also said, I think, paraphrasing a sign he had seen at a Dreamers rally, if one generation can build a wall, another generation can tear it down. Well, you know, imagine how that sounds to, I don't know, an American who feels threatened by low-wage workers from other countries. Tear walls down? It just seemed the wrong emphasis. It was certainly refreshing to see a young Democrat. When is the last time we've seen that? And he had the Kennedy gestures and moral fervor. That was great to see. And here, on the other hand, coming back to this it's great to defend pluralism and the Dreamers and so on. But if the Democrats are caught on that, let's put it this way. There's an article this morning in Nate Silver's website called "Whatever Happened to the Democratic Wave?" A month ago, it was in double digits, the generic congressional ballot favoring the Democrats. It is now down to 6 points.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punterful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. In other news this week, on Tuesday, United Airlines banned a woman from bringing her emotional support peacock on board a cross-country flight. A bystander captured the peacock's entrance.
I'm not kidding. This woman is wrangling her peacock into the airport. Right now, wrangling a peacock in the airport.
A rare super blue blood moon crossed the sky Wednesday morning. Lunar scientist Noah Petro said the next one is a couple of decades away.
The next time that we'll have this trifecta of events happening, an eclipse, a blue moon, and a supermoon, will be actually in, just under 20 years. It'll be January of 2037.
And on Sunday, Bruno Mars collected 6 Grammys. Among his awards, he won for Best Song for That's What I Like.
Gold jewelry shining so bright, strawberry champagne on us. Lucky for you, that's what I like, that's what I like. Lucky for you, that's what I like.
6 Grammys for Bruno Mars. You can join the conversation. Would you want to sit next to an emotional support peacock on a plane? What do you make of the father whose 3 daughters were abused by Larry Nassar, lunging for Nassar? My guests this hour, Mary Bruce, ABC News, Naftali Ben-David, The Wall Street Journal, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. And before the break, we were talking about the Democratic response to the State of the Union address. And let's go to Kate, who's calling from Shelburne, Vermont, who has a question about that. Kate, it's good to have you. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I felt like, of course, Representative Kennedy did a great job delivering the Democratic response, but my question for your speakers is, is there another choice, a fresh view, a fresh voice, a woman or a minority who could have brought the Democratic response to the table so that we can progress and have a fresh voice that so many of us were looking for and that didn't happen in the 2016 election?
All right, Kate, that's a good question. Naftali, please respond to Kate. I'd also love to know just how you felt in general about the Joe Kennedy choice for the Democrats.
Well, I think it's a terrific question, and I think the choice of Kennedy reflects something of a division within the within the Democratic Party after the last election, where some people said, you know what, we need to redouble our efforts to go back after the white working class. We're losing them. That's who used to be our base, essentially. And others saying, you know what, that's a lost cause. We need to redouble on our efforts to focus on the future, and that's minorities and young people and women. And I think Kennedy was an attempt to bridge the gap because he's young. He'd spoken Spanish. He talked about the Dreamers. But he also reminds people of John F. Kennedy, you know, the days when the Democratic Party was supported by many Catholics, certainly, but in general, white working class voters. He spoke in front of an old manufacturing plant, I believe. So, I mean, I think this was the Democratic Party leader's way of trying to do a little bit of both and have it both ways. So for that reason, I thought it was a particularly interesting choice, a young guy, but also a Kennedy.
Mm. And what do you make of the caller's request? Are there others, women, people of color, someone else that she'd rather hear from?
I mean, there certainly are many. I mean, it's you know, hard to know where to start. I mean, there's Cory Booker or Kamala Harris, for example, two senators who are also African-American who've made an impact. There are plenty of young Hispanic Democratic House members, Joaquin Castro. There's no shortage. This wasn't a decision that was made because there was lack of an alternative. Mm. It was Democratic leaders' way of saying, well, we'd like to do a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And I guess it's, you know, up to viewers whether they thought that worked. But that was the gap they were trying to bridge.
Right. Mary Bruce, what do you think? Did they bridge that gap successfully with Kennedy?
That remains to be seen, but I think you're absolutely right that there are certainly plenty of alternatives, young minorities, women who could have done this address. But what's interesting is a lot of those names are people who've been rumored to be eyeing a run in 2020. Congressman Kennedy is not on that list. Mm-hmm. And so I think that may have also played a factor here. And of course, they were trying to reach out to a certain audience. I mean, as you're just mentioning, you have a guy whose last name is Kennedy standing in front of an old car with its hood propped up, his shirt sleeves rolled up, speaking in a region that's home to the sort of working class voters that Democrats need as they try to regain Congress. But Kate's question is one that the Democratic Party is also wrestling with. Who is the future of the Democratic Party? Who are those young voices who are going to to rise up and be those stars that will propel the party going forward? And all of those questions then come up sort of summed up in this address.
Let's take a call. Larry is calling from Detroit. Larry, you're on the air. What are you thinking about this week?
Hello, Anthony. So what I'm thinking about is that the well, first of all, Saturday Night Live did a great skit a few weeks ago about the aging Democrat leadership. And I think that the problem that the Democrats have today is they've lost the focus on that central base, that working class American, and the Republicans are just cherry picking those people left and right. And when the Democrats are then forced to go to more fringe opinions or more fringe groups to shore up their count, they further alienate that base that they used to have, the middle class, working class American that used to be all Democrat all day long.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a huge factor in where they're at. And when you put a guy named Kennedy out as your speaker, young, good looking guy, but he's got so much money he's never had to work a day in his life, and the first thing he talks about is not having enough money, that they lost the audience right there at the beginning, I think, with him.
Well, Larry, it's an interesting point. I want to sort of move this conversation on a little bit. I mean, it's very much related to what we're talking about because it gets to the sort of future of the Democrats and the Republicans and the upcoming elections. And that is, there was news of another Republican congressman announcing this week that he will not seek re-election in 2016. Representative Trey Gowdy, a Republican from South Carolina, and Naftali Ben-David, remind us about Trey Gowdy, what we have to remember about him, and the significance of he's joining a pretty big group of prominent Republicans who have announced they're not going to be running again.
He is. There's a couple interesting things about him. For one, there's a symmetry to his retirement because he was elected in 2010, which was a huge Tea Party wave. It was also the first midterm election of Barack Obama and a big losing year for the Democrats. And now he's retiring in the first midterm election of President Trump and what Democrats, of course, hope will be a big losing year for Republicans. So that's one thing that really stands out. The other is that, you know, he personally was not in jeopardy, but he's a chairman of a committee, the House Oversight Committee. And clearly, you know, if the Democrats take over, he would no longer be chairman. So the fact that a number of chairmen have retired, I think, is a signal that perhaps some of them fear that they wouldn't be chairman in the next Congress, which means which is what would happen if the Democrats took over. But, you know, there's been about 40 House Republicans who have retired. And one of the signs of a wave is a massive retirements from the other side. It's not dispositive. It's what you could say was necessary, but not sufficient, you know, for a wave. And so the fact that there have been so many retirements by people who know their district very well and fear that they're in for something of a fight this year in a way that they haven't had in a while is a pretty good barometer of where things are.
Mary Bruce, 40 House Republicans saying they're not going to run. Do you see that as evidence of a coming wave in the election?
It certainly is an unusually large figure at this point in the election cycle, and it obviously helps to fuel optimism from Democrats that they may be seeing that wave coming. Now, many of those, we should point out, you know, like Trey Gowdy, weren't necessarily facing a competitive re-election fight ahead. He represents a safely Republican district. And there are others who have said they plan to seek other office. But there's no question that when you see that number, I'm sure it makes what is already going to be a pretty difficult year for Republicans even more difficult as we continue to see many key Republicans either resign or retire or announce they're not going to seek re-election.
Interesting. Jack Beatty, I'm wondering what you think about this, the significance of folks like Trey Gowdy and 39 others saying they're not going to run.
Yes, including people who still have time to go on their chairmanships of subcommittees or committees. Mr. Frelinghuysen in New Jersey, for example, he's not going to run, and that is those are the kinds of seats: New Jersey seats, California seats, New York State seats, states that are that are really hurt by the Trump tax plan. Those incumbents are very dangerous indeed, and so I expect you might even hear more from New Jersey and New York and California as the weeks go by. Hmm. Republicans saying, no, it's just turned against us.
Let's go to Jeremy, who's calling from Holton, Maine. Jeremy, you're on the air. Good to have you. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, thanks, Anthony. I'm a Maine independent, and I really would like to see some kind of a counterbalance to kind of hold off Trump a little bit. But I really think the Democrats have got to stop pushing these ultra-rich, elite, 1% kind of candidates. And Joe Kennedy, I mean, that just kind of highlights it. We need real, regular, everyday people as candidates, not these elitists to keep talking to us. And I think if they don't change, we're not going to be able to counterbalance President Trump's agenda.
Okay, Jeremy, thanks for that call. Naftali, real, regular, everyday candidates. Kennedy doesn't fit that mold, according to Jeremy in Maine. Who would? Or do you want to suggest to Jeremy another route?
Well, first of all, I mean, I don't think you could say Donald Trump represents that either. I mean, we have a bit of a history in this country of candidates who, you know, purport to speak for people whom they don't exemplify. And, you know, that may or may not be true of the Democrats coming up. I mean, sure. I mean, you could think of a guy like Sherrod Brown, who's a guy from Ohio. He has this gravelly voice. He sort of sounds like a working class guy, and he comes from a working class state. But the caller makes a fair point. The Democrats are really going to struggle with who to put up against Donald Trump this year. They know what they're going to be against. They don't know exactly what they're going to be for, or who could best personify that. You know, I mean, in terms of all these retirements, I mean, I think one thing that's probably worth mentioning is whether they will admit it publicly. For a lot of Republicans in Congress, it's really no fun to be asked day after day after day about the last thing that President Trump said or did, or his rhetoric, or somebody that he insulted, or what he said about Republican leaders or the Department of Justice. So it may be part of what may be happening here is just these guys saying, you know, I don't need this for another couple of years. It's not fun, and it's not really where I want my political life to be.
There's another story that I want to make sure we have time to touch on, and I'm afraid it's sort of, I say I'm afraid, because it seems like all roads lead back to the Russia story. But I want to ask you about the Trump administration's response to the Russian sanctions law. So last year, because of evidence of Russian interference in the U.S. election, both houses of Congress overwhelmingly approved legislation requiring sanctions against Russia and those that do business with Russia. Under the law, Monday was the deadline for the administration to impose those sanctions. Mary Bruce, they didn't really do that. What happened?
They essentially ignored Congress's will here, announcing that they would not impose these sanctions on Russia that Congress overwhelmingly passed. I think it was a State Department official who said that there's no need for new sanctions because the legislation, they argued, is serving as a deterrent, which I think you have to remember the big picture here, that these sanctions were actually intended to be more of a punishment than a deterrent. They were intended to be a counter to a range of Russia's actions, but they were also seen broadly as a response to Russia's meddling in the election. It was kind of a rare moment of actual unity on Capitol Hill when you saw such an overwhelming vote for these sanctions. And now it sort of sends this message from the White House and once again raises a lot of questions about why they wouldn't follow through on this, especially as we know that Russia's interference still continues.
Naftali, I'm sure this is really puzzling to a lot of listeners. I have to admit it's puzzling to me. So Congress passes this law. I mean, how can the president just ignore it?
Well, I mean, you know, the law gave the president the discretion to impose sanctions on certain people, and he chose not. There were two things that he was supposed to do. One is come out with a list of people who were influential in the Kremlin.
He did that.
And that they did, right. Although it seems like it was taken heavily from a Forbes list and perhaps from a Kremlin website. But it was a sort of, in fact, it was mocked in Russia for being sort of, you know, they took the Moscow phone book, essentially. You know, it seemed to be a slapped together list in many ways. And then they declined to impose sanctions. And I think the risk for the president is, first of all, it does play into these allegations that he's soft on Russia, but it also sends a signal, you know, that maybe they're not taking foreign affairs all that seriously. I mean, there doesn't seem to have been a lot of attempt within the administration to look at who really deserved sanctions, who really is influential in Moscow, but really sort of a thrown together thing so they can say that they followed the law without doing the kinds of things that the law was intended to achieve.
Mm. Okay, our time grows short here. I wanted to just make quick note of, and this completely changes the tone of this conversation, but there was a story, and it sort of advanced today, that I sort of have to rate as my favorite favorite story of the week. So United Airlines announced that it has updated its policy on allowing emotional support animals aboard flights. And this follows that incident last month that we heard about when a woman was forbidden from boarding a flight with her emotional support peacock. United said the animal did not meet guidelines for a number of reasons, including weight and size. The airline says that new rules have nothing to do with the peacock story, but it says that it's seen a 75% increase in emotional support animals over the past year, along with a significant increase of onboard animals. So we can speculate as to why there's such a growing need for emotional support animals. I think we'd all come up with some pretty interesting answers on that in this day and age. Finally, Mary, Naftali, and Jack, it's Super Bowl Sunday. I'm not sure if the three of you are football fans, but I'll start with you, Mary. What do you think about the big game? Who do you like?
Oh, man, this is a really tough one, but I'm going to go Patriots.
You're going to go Patriots. Okay, mm-hmm. The team that everybody loves to hate, except those of us here in New England. What about you, Naftali?
Well, I don't want to alienate your audience too much, but I'm like many people have issues with the Patriots, so I got to be rooting for the Eagles this time.
Okay. Jack Beatty, you're the resident New Englander on the planet, on the panel. Who do you like?
Well, I'll go with Philadelphia, if only because the Patriots strike me as the new Yankees. And I was brought up to hate the Yankee dynasties and the dominance over the Red Sox for generations. So to root for them is like, I don't know, rooting for capitalism or something.
Okay. Well, Mary Bruce, congressional correspondent for ABC News, thank you so much for joining us. Have a great weekend. And Naftali Ben-David, Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal, great to have you with us as well. Thank you.
Oh, thanks so much.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Jack, have a great weekend.
Thank you very much.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Follow me on Twitter at Anthony G. Brooks. And I am Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. Have a great weekend.